I'm going to present results from a recent global millimeter VLBI and deviate shortly to the longer wavelengths, but then I will want to present new results from the EHT March 2013. These are images which were not shown before. So, of course, the motivation is clear for everybody. We want to study how jets form. What is the physical origin of an AGN? We want to basically solve the enigma of the old problem, how do AGN provide energy and why are they so bright? We want actually to discriminate in the end what kind of launching mechanisms we have. Is it Blandford Payne, Blandford Snag? Is it spin conversion or not? And in order to achieve all these goals, we have to get high resolution. So everything is about resolution, basically. This sketch here, pointer isn't working very well, basically just it's taken from Alan Marsher, and we have here sort of a pointing flux jet at the very central regime, and with millimeter or centimeter VLBI, we probe just the tau equals one surface somewhere here, and as we go higher and higher frequency, we approach closer and closer to the core. If it's an adiabatic expanding conical jet, the frequency dependence is just linear, but in principle, it could be anything. We need these very high resolutions also in order to study the relation between gamma ray variability and component ejection. Many of you know probably that these AGN, most of them are all bright gamma ray sources, and the origin of the gamma ray emission is not completely clear. The spatial location of the gamma ray emission can be either somewhere in the jet or even close to the accretion disk in the broad line region. Coordinated monitoring between flux densities and broadband flux density and VLBI is potentially important to unravel that question and to find out if gamma rays and the ejection of new plasma into the nozzle are related. Very important measurable quantity, particularly if you have a very small array, is of course the size. So I just rewritten the standard formula for synchrotron self-absorption, solving for a size, and with a typical brightness temperature, which is limited by the inverse Compton limit, you find sizes of the order of 10 to 20 microarcseconds for those sources which are very close to that limit. And if you wish, you can also plug in other limits to the brightness temperature, like the equipartition limit, which is of the order of 10.11 or so. But characteristic sizes of 10 to 20 microarcseconds, and these sizes can be achieved by millimeter VLBI. So when you are able to measure a size and when you know the brightness temperature, you can, in principle, do a lot of physics. The size of the emission region, basically, is one, therefore, one of the primary parameters we can test, and accurate size measurements are extremely important to decide whether a jet is magnetically dominated or whether it is particle dominated, although the power law dependencies on these domination factors are very, very high. So accuracy there is really the main goal, and you can achieve this accuracy if your array is large enough and if you have enough redundant information so that you can get good estimate on the error bar. Directly translating that, of course, to the size of a black hole. This is here the standard formula, and this little alpha factor is just describing the metric. So depending on the distance, you find sizes for the galactic center, which are of the order of a few 10 microarcseconds. If you want to look at the maximum spinning black hole, the photon ring size has about 10.5 times 100 microarcseconds. And in the last stable orbit, you can, of course, be much closer. In the case of the galactic center, and also for M87, which is basically 2,000 times more massive, but also 2,000 times more distance, the numbers are comparable. So typical ISCO sizes of 4 to 5 microarcseconds are those which we ideally want to image, right? If we can reach a few 10 microarcsecond regions, we can do a lot of physics. If we take the previous results, and I really find it amazing that with a relatively small array, which basically gives you just a Gaussian point source where you have a size and a flux, then all the theory comes and you do all this kind of very interesting, nice modeling. So the trigger for that and why the people were so excited and still are excited is, of course, that in the case of the galactic center, with a size of roughly about 3.7 Schwarzschild radii, you are already much smaller than the size of the photon ring. So the big question is, what do we see? There are two possibilities. One is we just observe geometry. That means a crescent-like structure coming from relativistic light aberration. The other thing could be we are observing sort of an MRI or a hotspot or a shock in an orbiting disk. And of course, closure phase measurements will in the future allow to discriminate between these models. So this is just for the motivation why we want to do millimeter VUBI. And I think it is really important to note that there are several arrays already operational. And I think personally, we can disentangle between all the questions which have been addressed in the previous talks only with the multi-frequency approach. So we have to combine the highest resolution which we can get from the 1 millimeter or perhaps in the future 0.8 millimeter VUBI, but we have to combine that with the longer wavelengths in order to get Faraday rotation, to get spectral index and all the radiation properties which we can measure. And only with these additional numbers we are able to finally decide which of those many models which are in the air are correct. So here I list, for example, those arrays which we have, particularly the 3 millimeter VUBI array, which is a combination of European stations, which are very large and sensitive, which includes also the GBT with the VUBA. Then I'd like to remind you that there were fringes already detected on 150 gigahertz. At the moment, 150 gigahertz is not very fashionable, and the stations go more for the highest frequency in order to get maximum resolution. But the gap between 86 gigahertz, which at the moment is regularly performed, and the 230 gigahertz, which is only performed once or twice every 2 years, is really large. And in order to bridge that gap, it might be necessary in the future to consider intermediate frequencies in order to better determine spectral turnover, etc. So the global millimeter VLBI array is operational. It can be used by everybody. There's an open call for proposal twice per year, matched to the VLBA deadlines. And it now combines up to 18 stations. And with 18 stations, you can rely quite well on the quality of the maps. You can do not only phase self, but also amplitude self calibration. And as an example, why you want to use high frequency VLBI in a multi-frequency purpose or in a multi-frequency mode is, I'm looking here at a classical VLBI image of OJ287, which is here at 15, 43, and 86 gigahertz given. And of course, you have just an image and you don't know what is what. At the moment, we have not so much dense time sampling, so the kinematical information is poor. So basically, what is now the question is now, what in this double structure is the physical core? Where actually does the jet start? Does it start here or does it start here? If you look at that structure, the jet bends slightly south, so you might think this is the core. But if you put all the things together, and if you do what we call a spectral decomposition, that means a multi-frequency imaging of the source, we can get spectral indices of each of the components. It turns out that that one has the most inverted spectrum, and that that one is a stationary shock. So it is really necessary to do this. And as you see here, the core spectrum has a relatively steep spectral slope. It's inverted, but then saturates. And of course, we don't know how it continues here. So adding 230 gigahertz or any other high frequency will help to complete the picture and to find out what are the dominant physical processes and if everything is just synchrotron self-absorption or if there's something else. The 3 millimeter imaging is also necessary if you have a very sparse array to find out which of the many models which you can produce from such a sparse array is the correct one. So this shows, for example, an 230 gigahertz map, which was obtained during a test run using the APEX telescope, the SMA, and the SMTO. So we have here basically a triple structure with a typical beam pattern of the order of 37 times 50 microarcseconds, sitting deep inside what we call the nucleus of 3C279, which is a normal quasar. Actually one of the brightest, if it's in bright state. And here you may first realize that there is a north-south elongation, which is not parallel or so against the overall jet emission region, which the VUBI jet in centimeter wavelengths goes this way. So it is in principle now possible to identify those components, and with sufficient dynamic range, you could discuss various possibilities, which of those components here correspond to those here. As you can see, there's a sort of a double ridge line in 279, And it is well possible that the structure, the north-south elongated structure, which we observe at 230 gigahertz with the EHT, is just tracking this double ridge line at some point inside this 3-millimeter map. Now you can discuss various possibilities, compare the fluxes and sizes, and find out the most reasonable identification. But this figure also tells you very clearly that what you see must not necessarily be the apex of the jet. It is a certain region in the jet. It is compact, of course, but it must not necessarily agree with what we think is the jet apex, and therefore also perhaps the position of the black hole. So one has to be extremely careful, and only with multi-frequency observations it will be possible to find out which of the many physical scenarios is really possible. Now, towards a truly global VLBI, of course, it is important to add more stations. And in 2013, a big VLBI campaign was organized and combined most of those stations which are shown here. These lines here denote where fringes are found previously already. The little table here shows that this is a long-lasting effort which started actually by Pate in 1990 or so, who published the first ever 230 gigahertz fringes on an overall to BIMA baseline, I think it was. However, with a very, very low SNR of about 8 or 9 or something like this. In 95, and since then, we tried very hard to get VLBI fringes on longer baselines and with more sensitive stations. I remember very well the time when Chep and I were sitting at the SMTO, first trying to do a 2-millimeter VLBI and later going to 230 gigahertz. And it took basically from 2000 until now, 2013 or so, to really build up a global array which looks like this here. And the process of building up that global array hasn't finished yet. Of course, we are trying to add the South Pole telescope in next year. The Greenland telescope will come in. And of course, ALMA should come in pretty soon. So anyhow, this is a long, long history. And we need many, many stations in order to overcome the problems of image ambiguity. So if you want to achieve full imaging, you have to, in principle, have at least 10 stations so that the amplitude self-calibration also works very well. And that's why the VLBA, for example, is so successful, because it has enough stations which are very similar and where you can apply amplitude self-calibration methods to overcome limitations of inaccurately known gain and amplitude calibration information from the individual station and, of course, of the weather. So now we are very proud, of course, from the 2013 campaign to report detections. APEX was functional, and although it could observe only in one of the two possible polarizations, we have detected on the APEX to Kama baseline at 6 gigalambda M87 with a signal-to-noise ratio of about 10. And of course, quite unexpectedly, because the fluxes were not expected to be so high, we also detected the galactic center with a signal-to-noise ratio of about 7, at 5.7 gigalambda in not one scan, but in many scans. So these are the fringe rate spectra, and these clear peaks here and here show a very consistent delay, which is close to those expectations which you have from the overall geometry. This whole observing campaign was truly global in many aspects. It involved many stations, but it also used various sources, AGNs, observed and scattered through all the observing days of altogether 5 days. And this is just a list of the detections of these sources over the whole array. So these three columns are the detections to the APEX telescope. Here is the Kama SMA, the Kama SMT, and here the the SMT to SMA SNR. And if you look at the individual SNRs, you see they are depending on fluxes. But not only, it's not always that the brightest source also shows you the highest SNR. So the compactness degree is variable among these AGN. In this particular run, we observed Bialak, which was in flare state, and in this case, it actually got also the highest SNR. And as I said before, we have detected the galactic center and also M87 on the APEX baselines with an SNR of up to 11, on partly even on triangles. This work, of course, is only possible if all pieces of this technical system work together, and if all the people who are involved in these experiments, half of you sitting here, all basically come up with the necessary information so that in the end images could be made. So here is the new size estimate of the galactic center, now adding the apex baseline. This is the UV coverage. This is the apex baseline, which goes from here. So this is the east-west American to Hawaii coverage. And here are the baselines from US to apex. And if you fit the standard Gaussian with a size using, with two free parameters, the flux and the size, you come up with this, 36 micro arc seconds corresponding to the 3.6 Schwarzschild radii, which were published before. And the previous data just contained this here. And so this is basically the new data. And you see that the flux on the apex baselines is higher than what the model predicts. So if a circular Gaussian with that size would be present, we would expect to see a flux on the apex baseline of the order of 0.1 Jansky, but we see about 0.3 Jansky. So this is considerably higher. You see this also here in the visibility plot. This shows the model from the circular Gaussian fit, and these are the data. So there's about a factor of 3 discrepancy. And if you want to change the calibration of one station to match that, you have to square the number which you calculate here. So in principle, you would need to change the gain of apex by a factor of 2 to 3 squared in order to make the data matching. That's such high gain change is unlikely to be a miscalibration, because if we would be miscalibrated, we would underestimate the gain but not overestimate the gain. So therefore, I can pretty safely say a circular Gaussian of that size does not fit the observational apex data. So what else to do? Of course, the next thing to try is go away from circularity. You still have zero closure phases, which you want to maintain. You don't want to introduce asymmetry. So the next obvious thing is to try to fit an elliptical Gaussian. And indeed, an elliptical Gaussian fit matches what is observed quite nicely. So if we now look how that corresponds in the UV plane, so we have basically the old measurement of about 3.6 Schwarzschild radii. And I assumed at the moment, for simplicity, the same scattering law in both directions, which not necessarily must be true. Therefore, the size measurement in the other direction is 2.8. So the ratio of these two is roughly 0.8. So basically, on a north-south elongation, Sagittarius is 20% smaller than in east-west orientation. And one possibility to explain that would be, of course, here this crescent-like structure, which you would expect from a relativistically aberrated light. So if you fit that by an elliptical Gaussian, you just get such a ratio. Now I'm really running out of time, and I cannot go very much into detail. One important point is, of course, we could play similar games with M87. Here is a very new 3 millimeter image of M87, which shows that the structure which is seen here in this double ridge line is not so clearly visible at 3 millimeter, which suggests that we have a stratified jet, that only a fraction of the structure is visible. Probably we see a bright southern rim, which we can image at 3 millimeter. And also we detect here a counter jet. In the picture from our Japanese colleagues, Taiwanese colleagues, of course, the stratification here allows us to determine the distance to the black hole. But what happens if we have a double ray structure, if we have an edge brightening? Does the same model also apply if we indeed have sort of a bifurcation at the jet base as expected from MHD? So is the frequency dependent along this sheath, which is presently describing the outer layer of the jet? Is that really due to the -1? It's probably important to talk more intensely to those who model jets in order to make better predictions what the frequency dependence of the tau equals 1 surface in such stratified scenarios is. I also want to give a warning. These are two images from M87 made years ago with the GMBA. And you see, between 2 years, the structure can vary dramatically. And if you just think that is the core, you might be confused, because here is another component, which might be not the counter jet, but it's just a more self-absorbed position of the core. So from this, we have to also look at the kinematics. And if we just take those two epochs, which are obviously undersampling the kinematic evolution, we can get a speed of about 0.06c, but it may be, of course, much higher. If we super-resolve these images a little bit and compare those images which we obtain at 3 millimeter with the images which Hada has published, then we see this double ray structure here appearing here as well. But in the images at 3 millimeter, well, it's not disappearing. we see here it doesn't look like very much like a bifurcation structure. It looks like more a ring. I'm not saying that it is a ring, but you can draw a ring through it. And that ring size is, of course, a little bit large for the event horizon scale, so it's 50 times larger, right? Now, if we take the new data from the EHT run, 2013, a single Gaussian component certainly does not fit the data. This is an attempt to try to fit the data as good as possible with as few as possible components. In this particular case, I needed three components to fit the visibilities, including now the RPEX baselines. And if you translate into some visualization, you see that that would be the structure which you get if you accept the three-component model fit to those data. So you have a little quartet structure and something which is very ill-constrained and which somehow just describes the missing flux in the jet. So Honma is already getting up. My main message is with the RPEX data, we have new detections of the galactic center, and the sizes are smaller than previously thought, as well as for the galactic center as for M87. We are very close to three Schwarzschild radii in M87, and these data points now fit very nicely on this other line, which were plotted by Hada et al. So here's Gaussian size versus frequency. That's the 3 millimeter data point, and that's the 1 millimeter data point. And these numbers are smaller than the diameter of the photon ring, even for a maximum spinning black hole. So certainly we are observing something which may be not directly related to the disk, and maybe it's just a fraction of that, a sort of a hotspot perhaps, or some filament. Now I'm off. I don't have time to show you the Bialak data results. One interesting thing is when you do Bialak, there's also an image possible that is 86 to 30 gigahertz. If you combine the two numbers and do a little calculation, you find that the core is synchrotron self-absorbed. The turnover in Bialak is of the order of 230 gigahertz. And if you want to equate particles and energy, you would need an equipartition Doppler factor of 3 to 4, which is moderate. However, the jet speed observed further out is of the order of 10. So if you apply that jet speed, which has been observed by multiple observers over many, many years, you find that your ratio between magnetic and particle energy is way off. But of course, we don't know what delta on these scales really is, so it is, will be very, very important in the future to do kinematical study to really measure the motion of the jet on these scales of a few 10 Schwarzschild radii. Otherwise, we cannot disentangle what is geometry, what is motion, and what is intrinsic physics. And I think I stop here. With those technical remarks, the bottom line here is we need a large array, and it is extremely important to add the short UV spacings in the future, particularly the KAMA to KAMA reference antenna baselines fix the total flux density scale. And if you're looking at the visibilities, you see that you lose almost 50 or 80% of the flux on the first 2-3 gigalambda. So you are able to understand the source structure only if you have also a lot of short baselines in your array. And I think I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. We really would like to congratulate wonderful achievement. I mean, getting fringes from APEX, both on M87 and Sagittarius A star. That's really wonderful. So time for questions, couple of questions.
What is the orientation you've shown for the Sag A star system? Is that in any way similar to any other orientation we know?
Well, the orientation is, of course, full of error bars, and one has to study the systematics. So this is really brand new from basically back of the office. I've not discussed all of this in detail. The orientation here is basically sorry, this is the wrong slide. So it's basically given by the geometry. In principle, we are only sensitive to two orientations. So formally, you find a position angle, which is something like, well, that's wrong. This one, yeah, 57 degrees. But I would probably put an error margin on that of the order of 20, 30 degrees at least. I think these results are also consistent with what Jeff finds, Jeff Bauer, at 7 millimeter. The source is definitely in one direction more scattered than in the other. And if you look at the paper by Rusen Lu et al., we found that the position angle of the galactic center as a function of frequency varies, and as you go to higher and higher frequency, the position angle slightly turns. So this is the interplay between the intrinsic source structure and the orientation of the scatter disk. So as you go higher and higher in frequency, the scatter disk becomes less and less important, and you start to see the intrinsic orientation of this object.
It was just a quick comment in that direction, that this poor UV coverage, would you allow also to fit, for instance, an unresolved source on top of the circular Gaussian that you were using? To explain the apex over.
Well, but one other model would be, of course, to you cannot observe explain the data by a single Gaussian, but a Coriolis model would also be possible. So you would have a structure which is 36 microarc seconds in width, and then on top of that central, another more compact structure,
which is smaller. Unresolved component on top of the Gaussian. Yeah.